Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight. We have Gladys Berejiklian in here, who spoke to the Institute some time ago, about 10 years ago, but has always been a good supporter of ours, and she's the MP for Willoughby, Liberal MP for Willoughby, and she's going to introduce our speaker tonight. Gladys, thank you.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks to Jared and Anne, and good evening, everybody. As the granddaughter of survivors of the Armenian Genocide, it's my honour to introduce tonight's guest speaker, Professor Peter Balakian. Peter grew up in New Jersey, USA, and holds a BA from Bucknell University and a PhD from Brown University. He is the author of four books of poems, most recently Di's Thistle. His acclaimed memoir, Black Dog of Fate, which is up the front, has been awarded the 1998 Martha Obram Prize for Best Memoir. It was a New York Times Notable Book of 1997 and Best Book of the Year for the Los Angeles Times, Publishers Weekly and Library Journal. I'd like to read an extract of the New York Times book review, which said the following about the memoir. A fascinating and affecting memoir, written in sorrow and anger and with great sensitivity. Black Dog of Fate is at once a family memoir, a history of the extermination of the Armenians in Turkey, and the story of a young man's passage into adulthood. In calling for a formal acknowledgement of and apology for the victims of Armenian genocide by the Turkish government, Balakian wants closure for the victims and the possibility of forgiveness for the perpetrators. But some crimes are beyond redemption and cannot and should not be either forgotten or forgiven. Professor Balakian is a Reader Professor of the Humanities and Professor of English at Colgate University, where he teaches American literature, creative writing, a course on the Armenian Genocide and the Holocaust, and is a current director of Colgate's new Centre for World Ethics. For World Ethics and World Societies. He lives in Hamilton, New York with his wife and children. And whilst this is Professor Balakian's first visit to Australia, we've learned of his strong family connection to our country. His great-uncle, Harichun Balakian, migrated to Melbourne in the late 19th century after being a political prisoner in Ottoman Turkey. And his great-uncle was instrumental in assisting with the Australian relief effort for the victims of the Armenian Genocide. Please join with me in welcoming Professor Peter Balakian to address us this evening.
Thanks so much, Gladys. Thank you. It's great to be here with you. And I know your presence as an MP is greatly valued by many. I'm so very grateful to so many people at the ANC and the Armenian Genocide Commemorative Committee for all they've done. There are too many names to mention in a short time I have, but it means a lot to have worked with you to get here. And to be in Sydney is an absolute pleasure. The beauty of the city is new to me, and I look forward to the next 2 weeks in Australia. Very grateful to the Institute and Gerard Henderson for having me at this moment when much is happening, I realize. And so in 30 minutes, I'm going to try to do a couple of things. As efficiently as I can, I do want to use the map a bit. We can look at the map and see the part of the world we're talking about. You can hear me okay.
I think it's better to talk about it.
Okay, fine, yes. You see there is an Armenia on the map today in the yellow shoe that's landlocked in the Caucasus. You see the red line, the big red thick line, and I'm sorry the map isn't legible enough to read, it is in English. And you can see various phases of Armenia's territorial expanses over the course of time. You can see the particular area that circumscribed, the core of the Armenian genocide of 1915, and I'll show you more maps shortly. I'm going to push ahead to... show you some images of Armenia, historic Armenia, before the devastation, before the annihilation, before massacre, before deportation, before genocide. I was noting as we look at these images, you know, how diligently the Turkish government had to work to arrest and deport every Armenian man, woman, and child from terrains this remote and rocky. I'm not going to talk about the Sultan tonight. There's not time to do so, and I'm going to move through some images, and we're going to push. I'm not going to talk about 1909, but let's hold that image for a minute. What I'd like to do first is suggest to you, now for many of you, this history may be remote, may be new, and I'd like to put the history before you in some very concrete way. I mean, just to start, just to note the basics, between 1915 and 1918, about 1.5 million Armenians were exterminated through massacre and deportation by the Ottoman Turkish government. Two-thirds of the Armenian population living on its native homeland of some 2,500 years. So I think those facts are important to have. The idea that this is a Christian minority and the largest Christian extant minority living on its historic homeland is something important to know. Turkey, of course, was run by an Islamic theocracy at this time, and that's something perhaps we can talk about as well. Why is the Armenian Genocide important? I want to suggest that it began something, that it started a modern era, that it began the age of modern genocide. And by modern, I would note certainly that genocide as a problem, as an institution, is something that has plagued human civilization from the beginning of recorded history. You go back into antiquity and you find genocidal episodes. But modern genocide has something to do with the nation state, fairly newly evolved, actually, the nation-state by the early 20th century, using its technology, its bureaucracy, its modern technology and communication for the purpose of exterminating or removing or eliminating a targeted minority culture or ethnic group in a concentrated period of time. And so that is the kind of working notion I want to put before you as the Armenian event comes to mark the beginning of this modernity, if you will. Now, I think I'm going to don my jacket. I mean, undon my jacket. This is warm.
Just keep talking to the
microphone.
Okay.
Yeah. Indeed. Can you all hear me?
It's the first figure is undressed during the
season. Poets are always exhibitionists. The Armenian Genocide started something. It became a template for genocide to follow in the 20th century. I think to understand properly the Holocaust, genocide in Cambodia, in Rwanda, in the Balkans, in various parts of Africa, in Darfur today, one needs to come back to understand the anatomy, the shape, and the morphology of this event that came to be called the Armenian Genocide. Hitler's statement made 8 days before invading Poland in 1939, who today, after all, speaks of the annihilation of the Armenians, reminds us of how important memory is. And it reminds us that Hitler was inspired by the fact that the Turkish government succeeded in 1915 in eliminating a hated minority group. Okay, that the Turkish government's success emboldened Hitler, gave him a sense of inspiration, if you will, to pursue genocide against the Jews of Europe. And it also inspired him that the event which had been the most important human rights catastrophe, international human rights catastrophe of the second decade of the 20th century, had been forgotten within a generation. So we come to think about memory as a moral issue, as having moral meaning and moral value by Hitler's quote. Theodore Roosevelt, U.S. President Theodore Roosevelt, made the comment before World War I was even over that the Armenian massacre had been the greatest crime of the war. And I do think it's important that we situate the Armenian genocide in a World War I context. That we understand that to understand modern genocide is to understand the connection to World War I, just as to understand the Holocaust is to understand its connection to World War II. And how both perpetrator regimes used war as a screen and a context to articulate, to implement, to carry out a final solution for a targeted culture group. I think it's important as well to, well, we don't have a lot of time perhaps to talk about this today, but to think about the synergy between the Anzac landing at Gallipoli as a World War I moment that happens on the very same day as the Armenian genocide is beginning in Constantinople with the arrest of some 250 intellectuals and cultural leaders. On the one side of the Dardanelles, you have the Anzac troops. On the other side, you have the Armenian cultural leaders being arrested and deported. And it's been said by many historians that the Anzac moment, that the Gallipoli moment, was very much a catalyst and an amplifier for the Turkish rage at its interior minority groups, and notably the Armenians. Now, I also feel it's important, if you're studying U.S. history, to know that I'm not going to pursue this in depth today, that the effort to rescue and bring relief to the Armenians 8,000 miles away in the Ottoman Empire was, for America, its first international human rights movement. And this is a subject to much of my book, The Burning Tigris. Again, it's too much to deal with here in the time we have. I'm happy, of course, to answer questions concerning that issue. That puts it in an important place, however, in U.S. history, and there may indeed be some parallel for thinking about Australian relief during the Armenian massacres during the same period. There was Australian relief. Fourth, I would like to just briefly note the significance of the Armenian event in the evolution of modern international law and ethics. Of importance is this. In May of 1915, World War I not yet over. I mean, World War I just begun, really. The first year of the Armenian massacres not even over. The Allies made a pointed statement to the Turkish government. And their statement included this. If the massacres and the deportations of the Armenians continue, Turkey will be held responsible for, and the new phrase here is, crimes against humanity and civilization. So Turkey will be held responsible for crimes against humanity and civilization. A groundbreaking concept and a groundbreaking, piece of rhetoric. Secondly, the man who invented genocide, who coined the term, who spent his life conceptualizing the idea
of genocide, Rafael Lemkin, a Polish Jewish legal scholar, a brilliant man, really one of the pioneering thinkers of the 20th century, too little known. Lemkin, who lost 49 members of his own family in the Holocaust, coined the term genocide in part on the basis of his study of what had happened to the Armenians in 1915 at the hands of the Turks. And of course, in part, large part, on the basis of what was happening to the Jews before his very eyes in Europe in the late 1930s and early 40s. So we have the term Armenian genocide inextricable from the etymology of the modern term, of the concept. Lemkin was the first person to use the term Armenian genocide. Okay, the Turkish government likes to point fingers at Armenians and claim that the term Armenian genocide is somehow ethnically derived from Armenians. It's absolutely not true. It's a term that was used first on U.S. national television on February 1st of 1949. You can find the tape. It's actually on Andrew Goldberg's PBS documentary, The Armenian Genocide. And you can hear Lemkin saying, well, first the genocide happened to the Armenians, and then it happened to the Jews. And he's very candid, very casual in talking this way. So let me put those formative dimensions of this history. I'm not here to give a lecture about what happened. I'm happy to answer questions in that sense, of course, afterward. I'm not here to be comprehensive in any way, but I would like to highlight why this history has a very important place in the evolution of the modern age, the dark part of modernity, if you will. And I think that as you think about this event, you know, if it seems obscure to you or lost to you, I urge you to. There's an enormous amount of literature on the Armenian genocide of the last 15 years alone. I urge you to begin to explore the enormous bibliography, both primary and secondary sources, and to continue to think about the seminal nature of the event for the coming 20th century. Now, let me. I know this is a group that's interested in policy and that thinks about policy, and I want to shift gears here to talk about the campaign of denial that has consumed the Turkish government for 93 years. And I think it's important that we understand that the first response of the criminal is always denial, whether the crime is an individual crime or a mass state crime. The response is denial. The pursuit of acknowledgement usually comes out of the pursuit of justice and the meeting out of justice and accountability in the aftermath of the event. For example, Nuremberg had an important impact on establishing the parameter, the moral parameters around what happened to the Jews of Europe at the hands of the Nazis. There were trials in Constantinople after the Armenian genocide for the crimes against the Armenians and for crimes against prisoners of war. The trials lasted for a year and they fell apart. That's a longer story, and again, one I'm happy to get into in a Q&A. I'm not going to go there now. What I do want to do here, though, as we're talking about the denial, is to look at some of the perpetrators themselves, some of the architects of the extermination plan of the Armenians. Talat Pasha, who was the Minister of the Interior in 1915, oversaw really the whole project. It emanated from his bureaus in the directorship in his Interior Ministry. Enver Pasha, his cohort, certainly involved in the operation. I'm going to move forward here. I mentioned that on April 24, 1915, the Armenian intelligentsia was rounded up, deported, and most of them killed in the coming weeks and months. But I want to stop. We'll stop at an image here, a kind of image of Armenians being marched out of Harpert under armed guard, taken by a German businessman, May 1915. Let me come back to the denial, because these images allow us to see the texture and feel the texture of the moment. Look at that map for a second, a demographic map of the killing field showing you epicenters of the largest places of death. The Turkish government, in the face of this, an extraordinary body of evidence, and it's an unambiguous body of evidence, probably pushing the many tens of thousands of documents alone in foreign offices in Germany, Austria, Hungary, Russia, France, Great Britain. The United States alone has 40,000 pages of eyewitness detailed accounts of the massacres and deportations written by U.S. consuls stationed in the killing fields in 1915. So we have an enormous body of evidence. Let me establish that in some very brief way here. And then we have this massive campaign of denial in which the Turkish government has spent millions of dollars year by year, especially in the last couple of decades and more increasingly in the last several years, in desperate attempts to rewrite, sanitize, falsify, and counterfeit this history, to basically stop it from being acknowledged for the moral reality that it is. This denialist project has amplified Armenian attempts and needs for affirmation worldwide. And so there's been a kind of movement among nation states in Europe, South America, and the Middle East to acknowledge the events of 1915 based on the factual records. A couple dozen countries, major nations, from France to Poland to Greece to Uruguay to Lebanon and so on, have felt the sense of moral obligation about acknowledging the century's first genocide for a number of reasons. Ethical reasons, for reasons of redress in the face of failed justice, and in a sense, genocide done with impunity, and to stand up to the Turkish denial. And I would put before you some of the fundamental things that scholars of genocide say about denial. That it's the final stage of genocide because it seeks to demonize the victims and rehabilitate the perpetrators. And because it sends the message then that, of course, systematic state mass killing demands no accountability or response. And if that's true, of course, then more genocide is more plausible. I come back to Adolf Hitler's statement of 1939, who today, after all, speaks of the annihilation of the Armenians. Again, Hitler saw genocide had been done with impunity. So, we're faced with an ethical situation, a moral dilemma in some sense. I'm reminded, too, of what Elie Wiesel has said time and again, in particular about the Armenian case, that the denial represents a double killing because it kills the memory as well as the event. And that the survivor community and its legacy is robbed of a kind of moral order. So a 2,500-year civilization is eradicated. All of its cultural monuments, all of its towns and villages and cities. There is nothing left, basically. 2.5 million Armenians inhabited central, eastern, and parts of western Anatolia until 1915. Today there are 30,000 Armenians left in Turkey. In the face of that, the double killing has to be understood quite urgently. Why does it matter then that bystander states or third party states make statements of acknowledgement and recognition? Again, I think the occasion here of being in Australia only months after your Prime Minister's incredibly eloquent and rich and deep statement of acknowledgement about Australia's treatment of the Aboriginal peoples, about the stolen generations, is the most eloquent and rich statement of its kind I know of. I think people would agree that it sets a benchmark for the meaning of acknowledgement as an act of conscience, as an ethical act of verification, as a way of squaring a relationship between a brutal and unfair past and the hope for a better future, as a way of opening the way for amelioration, growth, healing, reparations, perhaps. I think the richness of that moment here, you know, points to obvious reasons why the Turkish denial stands out as something egregious, something violent, something racist, something that demands response. I also think it's important, as you are trying to get your head around the intensity of the Turkish denial, to understand that it is part of Turkey's deplorable human rights record. There's no way around that. One can't fudge it. When a country has had more writers and journalists in jail and in detention throughout the last decades of the 20th century, ahead of China and Syria, repeatedly documented by Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, I suppose we're not surprised that society is unable to deal with its own past critically, because critical thinking and intellectual freedom are outlawed in Turkey. You know, at this very moment, many of us have friends who are facing prison sentences in Turkey, like my own publisher, Ragib Zarakalu, who has given his life nobly for an extraordinary independent press that he runs, the Belgian Publishing House, because he publishes books about subjects that are outlawed in Turkey. The Armenian genocide, the Kurdish past, the Greek past, the Assyrian past, anything to deal with critique that involves minority pasts are subjects that are taboo. There's a lot more to say about that, but I think that we are dealing with a situation that is complicated, that has serious ethical ramifications, and that demands some world participation. The fact is, if you told any of us who worked in this field 15 or 20 years ago that in 2007 and 2008 the Armenian genocide would be on the front page of the New York Times several times in a 6-month period, once because of the assassination of Hrant Dink, another emblem of the abysmal Turkish human rights record, the brave Armenian journalist in Istanbul who was gunned down by nationalist assassins in January of 2007, or because the U.S. congressional attempt to pass an Armenian genocide resolution was being hammered by Turkish blackmail, cajoling, and coercion. These made the front pages of the New York Times with colored photographs, with big headlines, Armenian genocide, you know, disturbs Turkish worldview, etc. I would have said you were crazy. This history could not be that hot 93 years later. And the history is hotter than ever because it has been allowed to remain unresolved. It has been allowed to be an open wound. It has been allowed to fester. And so, as one thinks about reconciliation with truth and the role of third country, third party nation states as ethical bystanders, I put these notions in my brief time period here with you before you, and I'm happy to open the floor for conversation. So, thank you.
So thanks to the Armenian National Committee of Australia for alerting us to our speaker's visit here today. And they've got down the front a couple of Peter Balakian's books, Black Dog of Fate and The Burning Tigris. I think they're $30 each, right? They're pretty cheap. You can always get a bargain at the Sydney Institute. Pretty cheap. So we come to question discussion. We'll end no later than 7. Can I just lead up and just ask... couldn't cover all the ground today, but why was it in 1915 that the Ottoman Turks turned on the Armenian minority? What was the policy directive then that compelled what happened?
Right.
I'll come back to the mic.
The question is the why question. It's a complicated context, and again, to try to compress it into a short answer. It's important to understand, first, the notion of infidel status in the Ottoman Empire, to understand the Armenian genocide. Christians were treated legally at a different status, at a different level, as were Jews, as were peoples of the book minorities, were treated, lived in a different layer of legal, social, and economic structure. I don't have time, and the tax structure was pretty brutal. And the prohibitions on being part of government, being in the military, being in the civil service, Armenians were, like other Christians and Jews, were absolutely marginalized from the mainstream of Ottoman life. They could do okay in certain areas, and those areas tended to be trade and commerce, the professions, and education. I think the parallels here with the Jews in Europe are very deep and interesting, because Jews too being marginalized from certain segments of mainstream infrastructure also prospered in areas that had to do with trade and commerce, professions, and education, and became stereotyped negatively by a resentful majority or hegemonic sectors of the societies they lived in, their host cultures. Armenians, to put it in a nutshell, by the late 19th century, began to protest, most of the time peacefully and civilly, for change and reform from their infidel status, legal, political, economic, social, religious areas of life. Things that involved the pursuit of liberty, security, and security often meant the security of women from rape, abduction, and sale into harems. This was a chronic problem among the minorities, among the non-Muslim minorities. Armenians really did push the political envelope. They were edgy in doing so. They staged protests in downtown Constantinople, as the city was called then. They were really asking of the Ottoman state this question, in my opinion. Can a Christian be the equal of a Muslim in the Ottoman Empire? It was a tough question to ask. It was a dangerous question to ask. And it was answered with wholesale violence. I mean, let me just backtrack on my... I'm sorry, I'm going forward here. Let me backtrack here to Sultan Abdulhamid II, because this event is a major event. 1894 to 1896, 200,000 unarmed minority members of Turkey are slaughtered because that question was being asked, because those protests were made, because a civil rights movement was underway. The Armenians, by the beginning of the 20th century, had become a problem for the Ottoman ruling elite. They were a Christian minority looking for change and freedom and something different, something new in the face of infidel status. And they had the sympathy of Europe. And this, of course, angered the Turks a great deal. And the Ottoman Empire was in an acute phase of decline. And the empire was losing its lands. And so in times of crisis, the propensity toward mass violence internally is always greater. Irvin Staub, the social psychologist, talks a great deal about the idea of low self-esteem being part of genocidal episodes in his book, The Roots of Evil. These are some of the factors. I would also note that World War I provided an opportunity because it creates a militarized society, it creates a screen from the outside world, and it also accelerates the techniques for mass killing. And there's a lot more to say about that. So World War I becomes a crucial moment. Yes.
Well, hang on. I'm going to run this.
Take it away.
Here, then we go there. Okay. Yeah.
Have the testimonies in the Australian of Australian prisoners of war that have been looked at, I understand, recently added anything to knowledge about the genocide, the witness accounts?
You know, I was listening to Colin Tatz talk about this on the radio show I did with him last week. With Philip Adams, and I hadn't read any of those narratives, but he made it clear that there's a rich body of literature of Australian and New Zealander prisoners of war who have written about, you know, their own eyewitness experience of massacre and deportation. I mean, it's a very rich piece of narrative that's out there to be explored, and I hope that that will happen. That's a good point, and I think it's waiting to happen.
Those papers at the Australian War Memorial.
Okay.
Yeah. I wanted to go on from your first answer. The war was the shield, but it's often with genocide being the defeated nations where we've been able to bring justice to bear. I mean, because Germany was defeated, Nuremberg, Cambodia, the killing fields becomes an international thing.
Right.
And in a sense, Turkey was on the losing side.
Right.
How was it they got away with it? And, it's extraordinary that they did get away with it, in a sense, historically, for so long.
Yeah, I mean, we could adjourn to, a seminar for the next 3 hours and talk about that very important issue. How did a nation that was on the losing end of World War I end up getting away with what they did? Well, again, I'll try to do this briefly. After the war, the British were the dominant Allied power in Turkey. They were the chief occupier. And they pushed the succeeding Ottoman regime, the Young Turks. I'll show you them again. The Young Turks fled the country and were given asylum in Germany. Court martials were put on, 1919-1920. They were military tribunals, and they really were groundbreaking in what they were doing, because the Turks were forced to try their own for crimes against humanity and civilization, as the Allies had said they would be, for the massacres of the Armenians and for crimes against prisoners of war. The trials lasted for a year. Some mid-ranking Ottoman officials were sentenced to death and a few executed. This caused enormous outrage in Turkey. I mean, it was unacceptable that Muslim bureaucrats, government officials, should be executed for killing Christians. It was simply not a tabulatable idea. There was enormous resistance in the popular culture. And then something quite dramatic happened, and that was that Mustafa Kemal began to create his movement, his nationalist movement, that would, of course, engage Turkey in a civil war at the same time as it was in a war against the Greek invasion on the West Coast. This chaos disrupted the trials, but it also, in its net result, pulled Turkey out of the post-war situation with a new republic. And the new republic refused to take responsibility for the old empire. And through very clever, you know, diplomacy that Ataturk pulled off with the Europeans, he managed to both distance the new Turkish Republic from the Ottoman past and convince an already enervated Europe that the Armenian thing should be banished from memory. And it's interesting because at the Treaty of Sevres in 1920, Armenia was awarded. Do I have that? I think I have the image. Let me show you what Armenia was awarded. So you can see what the original treaty... You can see what the Treaty of 1920 was awarding. So that's the Woodrow Wilson Treaty of Sevres award of 1920. Now, how you can go from that map to the Treaty of Lausanne in 1922, where Mustafa Kemal has convinced the European powers that the word Armenia must be removed from what was the Treaty of Sevres, in which Armenia had several pages of a whole chapter. So we had a really quite unusual about-face between 1920 and 1922-23. It's a bizarre story, but it's really at the core of why the denial process was able to escalate as it did, that a kind of historical blackout had been actually institutionalized by the modern nation-state.
Just a very quick follow-up for that. We Australians know what Ataturk was doing in April 1915, but was he in any way associated with the subsequent genocide that occurred after that date? So what was Ataturk's role during the genocide?
Ataturk's role in killing Armenians was most dramatic in 1918, in the fall offensive against the new Armenian Republic in the Caucasus. So yes, he was very determined to see Armenia removed from the map of Turkey. He wasn't involved in the massacres and deportation process in 15, 16, or 17. It was 18 when he gets involved in the eastern frontier and the movement to expunge. If you go back to that very beginning map, look, you can see in the Caucasus, for example, you see the dotted line under the Arax River. Armenia controlled that in 1918, and the Turkish invasions, which really were committed to wiping out the rest of the Armenians in the world in the Caucasus, went in and got some of that land, pushed Armenia back into that little kind of boot that you now see. And the Armenians, in a valiant battle in 1918, held the Turkish army off and saved what's left of Armenia. That was Ataturk's project.
Okay, so there's a question there. Yes.
The question I have is that, are you saying now that modern Turkey refuses to accept the Armenian genocide? And if that be so, doesn't that make it very difficult for them to enter the European Union unless they recognise what they did in relation to Armenia?
I think so. While acknowledgement of the events of 1915 is not at the top of the EU's list of issues, there's so many other issues that Turkey has to deal with. Most basically, intellectual freedom in its own society, Cyprus, Kurdish problem, etc. These issues are preoccupying the accession gatekeeper. The Armenian issue matters a good deal because it's sending the message that here's a society unwilling to even be reflective, even be thoughtful about an enormous human rights history in its own past. I think many of us conclude that the Turkish denial project is self-destructive, and maybe willfully so. You know, one theory is that nationalist groups inside Turkey do not want EU entrance because it means a change of paradigm, a big change of paradigm for them. So I would agree with you that if Turkey really wants EU admission, the acknowledgement of the Armenian Genocide is really important.
You mentioned that the Armenian Holocaust has been repeated throughout history. So I have a rhetorical question to which you may not have an answer. We know how to send man to the moon, invent computers, but we cannot solve basic human problems. Right. What do you suggest?
I need God's help to answer that. But
don't go to the moon.
The UN
take over. Let me, again.
Well, you're a Christian. You're talking about the fall.
I was using God in a loose way. let me, you know, reflect on this very briefly. I do believe, that the human propensity for violence is extraordinary. We saw 130 to 150 million people killed in the 20th century from war and genocide and human rights atrocities. It's a staggering concept. One cannot get one's head around it. I do think some hopeful signs in the last quarter of the 20th century have shown, and some of the hopeful signs involve the evolution of international tribunals, of genocide perpetrators being convicted at war crimes tribunals in Europe, at The Hague, for example. Some evolution of international human rights NGOs worldwide. The UN has potential, but its potential is only as good as nation states allow it to be. And if national sovereignty is going to be the god that runs every nation state, the UN will not evolve as it could evolve. I think you could make an argument for an international constabulatory, a kind of international human rights army. That idea has been put out there. I think there needs to be a lot more creative, proactive activism on solving human rights problems, but I think some infrastructures are in place, and we have to have hope.
Thanks. There's a question here, then we go there and then.
You raised the question of the difficulty of a Christian or Jew being regarded as equal in a Muslim society such as Turkey was. What is the situation at the moment, say, for the Armenians in Syria, or Christians, say, in Iraq? Do you know anything, whether this sort of problem is being resolved in the Middle East?
Well, that's a very good question, and I do think that to answer it accurately, one does have to go country by country, culture by culture. I would not want to generalize about any relationship between Christians and Muslims in any essentializing way or generic way. I think, for example, Armenians in Syria in many ways have had a reasonably safe and prosperous culture. The same is true with Armenians in Lebanon. They've been very active, dynamic elements of those societies. There has been a positive Arab-Armenian synergy. And I would remind you that in the decade of the collapsing Ottoman Empire, the Arab world in general was full of outrage at its Ottoman colonial rulers and was working hard for its own freedoms and independences, which happened after World War I in various ways through colonial processes as well. So you had an Arab-Armenian relationship that had some common grounding even back in the 1920s and 30s. Armenians in Iraq, it's been rough. Under Saddam, I think it was rough. It's rough now as well because of the chaos that sadly. The country I come from has created. That's, you know, to answer you about a few of those of countries in a short time, the situation in Turkey has been the worst of all of that for Christian minorities. I think that's without a doubt.
Yeah. You've spoken of the persecution of the Armenians in Turkey. Could you give us some comparison as to what the Turks have done to the Kurds versus what's been done to the Armenians? Could you put that in context?
Could I put in context the treatment of the Kurds inside of Turkey? Again, very complex history and full of ironies in the Armenian, from an Armenian perspective, because during the 1890s and during the period of the genocide, 15 to 18, Kurds are important members of the killing squads. The Kurds did a lot of killing. If you look at that map here, you can see that historic Armenia and historic Kurdistan overlap a bit, and there was a sense that the Turks were wily rulers, and they understood dividing and conquering would be successful, and they got the Kurds to work for them on the killing project of Christian minorities in the neighborhood. And yet, what happened after World War I was that the Kurds would become the next Armenians, if you will. And I don't want to neglect to say here that the Assyrians and the Greeks, the other dominant Christian minority cultures in Turkey during the 1890 to 1922 period, I don't want to neglect to note that they were wiped out, that they were victims of genocide in different contexts and in different ways. They're gone. I mean, there were more than 4 million Christians in Turkey in about 1895 after World War I. There were a couple hundred thousand. But the Kurds became the next targeted minority. And there are claims, and I know less about this, that the Kurds in the Dersim region, in the North Pontic region, in the central part of Turkey, were wiped out in a genocidal campaign in 1938-1939. In the modern era, there are two ways of looking at the Kurdish resistance to, the Kurdish civil rights movement against, Turkish repression. You know, one narrative, the PKK, is a separatist revolutionary movement. In another narrative, the PKK is simply asking for human rights and civil rights. 5 years ago, the word Kurdish was illegal in Turkey, and a person of Kurdish origin could not call him or herself a Kurd. The only term that was acceptable to the state was Mountain Turk. That's changed now. You can use the word Kurdish, but if a Kurdish pop singer got up at a music festival in Istanbul 3 years ago and began to sing in Kurdish, and a riot broke out and a dozen people were killed, then you get a sense of how deeply repressed Kurdish identity and Kurdish rights are. So the Kurdish struggle, again, is a human rights struggle. Tens of thousands of people have died in the last 25 years, and there are 22 million Kurds. So this is not a simple problem for Turkey.
First of all, I'd like to thank you for an excellent presentation on the background to the Armenian genocide. I'm sure we're all wiser now. As one who has somewhat similar roots to yours, where atrocities have occurred, I was disappointed to hear that not once did you mention the word Russia. And to my mind, Russians were just as big or bigger carriers out of atrocities, or 35, since 1940, something like 3,500 gulags, yeah. All the mass deportations.
Okay, I agree with that. Can you just bring it to you?
May I suggest that in your future presentation you include these people as well?
Because we're having a talk on the Armenian genocide, we're not having a talk on Stalin's gulag.
I would say this one thing here, that in the very quick mention of large cases of genocide from the Armenian to the present, I would say that the Ukrainian famine genocide of the early 1930s is an important thing to know. That's one place I am happy to make an inclusion. I thank you for bringing it up.
Okay.
We're getting near the end, so we've got our final question.
Yeah. Peter, would you be able to, if you wish, to elaborate a little bit on the geopolitical kind of depravity that I think is engaged by the superpowers previously and the United States now, where they have continuously tried to trade away human rights issues in favor of, national security or, the broader now war on terror. And I think a perfect example has been recently how Condoleezza Rice frankly stopped the issue of Armenian genocide being raised and discussed in the Congress because of the issue with regard to the Turkish protest, with regard to the war in Iraq. So it's really interesting if you have...
Right. Well, I mean, again, if we have a three-hour seminar, we can have this conversation in depth. But look, let me say three things very quickly. One, the U.S. Congress had voted in favor of an Armenian genocide resolution. There was no denial, and there was no confusion about the history. That's a positive thing, that it was the most crass level of bullying and coercion from Ankara to our State Department that forced the U.S. State Department to cave. The really demoralizing thing about that, if you're an American citizen, Armenian or not, is that, there's such little moral leadership at high levels. Your legislative bodies are doing pretty well, frankly, but the State Departments are not. They play a kind of pragmatic politics that sometimes really needs to be transcended for ethical considerations. Again, your current Prime Minister Rudd strikes me from the outside as being a person of extraordinary ethical idealism and courage. And again, I go back to the apology of February. I think there's, the problem you're articulating is a problem that is chronic to issues of human rights, rescue, relief, and prevention in the modern era. In fact, we have not come up with adequate paradigms or methodologies through which nation states can put aside self-interest for the cause of the human and of saving human lives. And I think that's not unrealistic. I think it's something that has to be a priority in the 21st century. I think there are signs of positive evolutions. That's a whole other lecture and a whole other talk, and I'm not an expert on that, but I do witness what's going on. And I think we have to get there, and we have to get there through leaders who have visions and grassroots networks that have energy and commitment and are tireless in pursuing. We mentioned just lastly how important the Darfur crisis is and how inept nation states worldwide have been in bringing some end to an endless genocidal project that's been going on for 4 or 5 years now.
Just finally, as you know, 1941, we linked up with the Soviet Union because of Germany was a greater threat. So these harsh decisions have to be made all the time. But tell me about your own role in the United States, going back to your book, The Burning Tigris. I mean, you've obviously had quite an impact in pushing the Armenian issue into into a greater public awareness.
Well, that's kind of you to say. I mean, I can only say for myself is that I'm a writer, and I've written two prose books that deal with this history. I'm grateful that they've had some success, that they've reached a wider audience in the States, and, makes one feel that scholarly work and intellectual work and texts can matter and must matter. I mean, I'm not speaking about my own here. If they have, that's good. But I mean that books, that the intellectual project, that the scholarly project has an enormous role to play in education and change. It's one of the things I was talking about last night to the Armenian community, how I do believe that the denialist campaign of the Turkish government in the U.S., for example, I think has been rendered impotent by intellectual work. There's been good grassroots activism as well, but if you don't have the text, if you don't have intellectual work, nothing can happen. And that's true in every culture. I know it's true in your culture. You have a lot of talented
writers, scholars, a lot of books coming out all the time that are making change happen. And clearly, Prime Minister Rudd's moment was preceded by a lot of good intellectual work to make that apology happen.
Many thanks. Take a seat. Very brief, Anne, and I thought it was appropriate as we, in the lead up to Anzac Day that we do something with a slight difference. And Peter's visit to Australia made it possible. In Australia, it's often said we invaded Turkey in 1915. Of course, those of us know we invaded the Ottoman Empire in 1915, which was an ally of Germany. And so we know a bit about Turkey through sad events of almost a century ago. But it's always been important, and Anne and I have both done it, and we've had discussions at the Institute as well, to talk about the Armenian Genocide, even in the post-9/11 situation, where it's probably more difficult for strategic reasons than it was before 9/11. So I'm very grateful you've come here tonight. It's a very good paper. It'll go well on the Sydney Papers. It'll be up on our podcast as a significant summary of highly complicated and very sad event, but you've done very well tonight. Thank you. Copies of Peter's books there, and I'm sure he'd be happy to sign any for those who want them. Thanks. But someone's running, and I'm not. So,
it's all
you have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.